to the present time, we have approached our Greek problem largely diagrammatically, or in the effort to outline some elements of the pantheon and the outer structure of the religion. To most students of Greek philosophy, this has been enough, because in our modern Western life, we are not accustomed to a divided theology. That is, we are not accustomed to the idea that there is one obvious doctrine and behind it another not obvious and not always identical with the exterior part. Ancient peoples did not demand that their outer and inner religions be identical. They demanded, however, that the outer religion should lead naturally toward the inner religion, and that nothing learned exteriorly should conflict with that which is later discovered to be true interiorly. Thus, the outer fables and garments formed a vestment within a living body far more important than the robe which it wore. And in effort to attempt a summary of some of the elements of this, we are going to approach phases of Greek theology tonight which come very close to some of our so-called esoteric systems in the world, particularly Vedanta, Yoga, and Northern Buddhism. Essentially to point out not the parallels between one faith and another, but to point out the largeness, the unfolding sufficiency of the Greek religion itself for those who lived under it and attempted to rise to a better way of life according to its teachings. It is quite obvious that the noblest of the Greeks must have had certain inner consolation beyond mythology, and that pure intellection was not the source of this consolation. For in almost every instance, they clearly reveal not only the breadth and depth of their thinking, but the sublimity of their spiritual convictions. These convictions must flow from and be supported by an adequate religion, a sufficient and proper participation in spiritual value. So we're going to approach some of the side issues of this in an effort to clarify our principal point. And we will begin by a study of the natal daemon as it is found in Greek philosophy. Now, in the dictionary, if you will look up the word daemon or demon, D-A-E-M-O-N, you will find that it does not mean a devil or an imp of darkness. The word means originally, and so the dictionary tells us, it meant a deity of a secondary or tutelary order, and it also meant a spirit. It is only by extension that the word came to have any implication of demon as we commonly use it today. For many years, I made a point of dividing the pronunciation, calling one our familiar term demon, and the Greek form daimon or daemon. The dictionary, however, prefers us to use the same pronunciation. But let us bear in mind that this evening, wherever we use the word demon, we are using it in the Greek sense, as a god, and not as an evil being. Only in passing may we mention that the transforming of the Greek divinities into demons was largely the result of the rise of Christian theology, in which it was sincerely believed that these older gods were false, that those who followed them worshipped false gods, and were led astray by infernal forces, it being assumed that these gods were really devils in disguise. This was a medieval theological thought, which I think it is perhaps well time for us to outgrow. The word demon, therefore, simply means a certain kind of god. Perhaps the most famous historical example of this is the demon of Socrates. This was an invisible spirit who counseled the philosopher throughout his life, who formed a source of oracular revelation, and who was his consoler, friend, confidant, and guardian through the many long years of his troubled earthly ministry. That Socrates would have chosen an evil spirit to be his guardian is utterly out of key with the nature of the man, nor should we assume that this spirit was regarded as some Mephistopheles to an ancient Grecian Faust. Such is not the intent. What Socrates is talking about is the natal demon, and this, therefore, will be the first thing that we will attempt to understand. The Pythagoreans and the other Greeks tell us that the numerical power of the demon is 6. And you will find that in Plato and many other writings, numbers become exceedingly significant. The reason why this demon is 6 is because it represents a being or power that is the result of an aggregate of 6 factors, elements, or parts. When we look into the constitution of man, searching for this natal demon that might have been lurking in the background of the constitution of Socrates, we realize that there is only one structure in man that precisely fulfills both the physical and metaphysical implications of a 6-fold entity in man. And that is, of course, what we call today the human ego personality. This personality, as Buddha points out, is the aggregate of the 6 sense machine. In other words, it consists of the 5 senses and the mental element. These together constitute a kind of being. And for the most persons, this kind of being is the only being that they know. Now, we might go a little further. The average person, in relation to this 6-fold being in himself, though he lives with it and is in constant communion with it, and it participates in every function of his life, the average person is unaware of its nature and only occasionally responsive to its true inclinations and impulses. We live in constant conflict with ourselves. And as St. Paul says, when we would do good, evil is ever nigh unto us. We have a terrible time even living up to the natural advice and admonition of our own compound intellectual entity. So we live below ourselves almost constantly. We live less than we know to be right. We live contrary to what we know to be prudent. We perform actions which we know to be dangerous to our lives, our health, and our happiness, thus constantly entering into a state of conflict with even the aggregate which we call ourselves. This means, to a degree, that what Socrates knew as his natal demon represents the structure of experience consciousness arising out of man's sensory contact with externals and his contemplative reflection upon contact. In other words, we live every day in a world of experiences. These move in upon us. Perhaps subconsciously they move in more than we realize. And this internal self grows more rapidly than the external, possessing a greater body of knowledge than the external realizes that the internal nature actually does possess. The Greeks also had a certain further thinking about this, to the effect that, as Buddha pointed out, this complex of the 6-sense machine, because it is the basic cause of rebirth, constitutes, as the Tibetan points out, the continuity between lives. Consequently, the individual who possesses the sense of self-existence is perpetuated from one corporeal body to another simply because of his dominant acceptance of the fact of self-existence. It might follow, as the Neoplatonists reasoned, therefore, that the natal demon can be not only this aggregate as we know it today, but the aggregate of karmic accumulation. It can be that which we have been in relation to what we are, causing some of the Greeks to refer to this demon as conscience. Conscience being, in a sense, therefore, man's overknowing in relation to his present doing, which, if out of harmony therewith, can also be the immediate cause of psychic stress. This concept is sufficiently interesting to us for perhaps the purpose of exploring it a little further. And in order to simplify this and make it as brief as possible, I want to read a few lines from a paragraph in our lectures on ancient philosophy relating to this particular subject. Here we have Apuleius writing in his commentary on the God of Socrates and paraphrasing the teachings or words of Plato. And then here's what he tells us concerning the peculiar demon that is allotted to every man, who is a witness and guardian of his conduct in life, who without being visible to any is always present, and who is an arbitrator not only of his deeds but also of his thoughts. Then we will skip a little and read on. All you, therefore, who hear this divine opinion of Plato as interpreted by me, so form your minds to whatever you may do, or to whatever may be the subject of your meditations, that you may know that there is nothing concealed from those guardians, that is, from these demons, either within the mind or external to it, but that the demon who presides over you inquisitively participates in all that concerns you, sees all things, understands all things, and in the place of conscience dwells in the most profound recesses of the mind. For he of whom I speak is a perfect guardian, a singular prefect, a domestic speculator, a proper curator, an intimate inspector, an assiduous observer, an inseparable arbiter, a reprobator of all that is evil, an approver of all that is good. And if he is legitimately attended to, sedulously known, and religiously worshipped in the way in which he was reverenced by Socrates, with justice and innocence, will be a predictor of things uncertain, a premonitor of things dubious, a defender of things dangerous, and an assistant in all time of want. Now that is the definition of the function or action of this demon. Let us therefore contemplate the Platonic concept, which incidentally later came down into the church, which, though it had no time for demons, did develop out of the Assyrian-Chaldean concept, which was likewise supported by the Egyptians, that man is born with a kind of an attendant spirit. This is called, in medieval Christianity, the guardian angel. And under the definition of the guardian angel in the canons of the faith, it is stated that the belief in such a being, though not canonical, that is, not official or sanctified by theological legislation, that such belief is of the mind of the church. That is, that it has been generally and universally accepted, and those believing in it are in no way subject to rebuke by the church. Now, the guardian angel and the natal demon of Socrates represent, therefore, essentially one thing. They represent the level of the mental entity conscience and consciousness of the individual, the level which apparently is his present level, but the level to which factually he has not generally ascended. In other words, the individual has not reached identity with himself, even as a corporeal, objective person. He is not using his own thoughts as fully as possible. He is not living as well as he knows. He is not thinking as truly as he is capable of thinking. Therefore, in relationship to his conduct, as it is daily expressed in action, the natal demon signifies a level above his normal reaction to things. Thus we find in the Socratic concept that the first labor of man in his ascent of the mysterious ladder of unfolding union toward the gods, that the first step of this descent is that the individual shall come into harmonic integration with what might be termed the common level of his own capacity. To do this, he must be as Socrates was, honest, fearless, free from all inclination to mental subterfuge, not given to equivocation, free from compromise, and dedicated wholly and completely to the conduct of his own affairs according to the convictions of his own conscience. To achieve this is to result, therefore, in a general purification or catharsis of his nature, by means of which he becomes that which he already is capable of becoming. He gains the power to make use of his faculties, the normal and common faculties of his time. For you will remember that Socrates made a great deal of the fact that he was in no way a superior person. He was no way divinely endowed. He possessed no strange powers which transcended the abilities of common men. He thought not with a brilliance or a profundity in the common sense of the word. He thought with a strange, almost cataclysmic directness. He thought with the wonderful capacity that so few of us have of taking two and two and putting them together and making four, something that is very difficult for us to do. We nearly always can put two and two together and get some kind of a mysterious multiple which satisfies our feelings but is contrary to our facts. If then we should come to the conclusion that by the demon is signified the mental complex of man, abiding constantly with him, associated with him in all things, and according to Iamblichus and the Mysteries of the Chaldeans, that after death, this demon becomes the conductor of the soul, bringing it before the gods and testifying to the attainments of that soul, incapable of being deceived or having concealed from it any fact relating to that soul. In other words, that man, no matter how he conducts himself or what he does, must in the fullness of time, as Socrates pointed out, come face to face with himself and must accept the final judgment of himself upon himself. This is the judgment of the demon. And perhaps it does take on a slightly morbid and infernal situation when some individuals, having that long heart-to-heart talk with themselves, find it a most unpleasing experience. But so often in life, we are plagued by our own conscience, and we wish sometimes that we could dismiss it or would like to regard it as an imp of perdition, prodding us to things we do not wish to do. Now we have therefore now established a level, the Socratic level, the level which is the first common labor of man, and that is the bringing of the objective personality of the individual into a harmonic accord, the union of the six powers to produce within themselves that rather simple, but by very simplicity, beyond deception, part of man's nature. Now, in this, the Greeks differ somewhat from the Oriental. The Oriental assumes, or at least he is assumed to assume, that the products of this natal demon are essentially illusionary. Therefore, that the six sensory machine cannot produce anything but karmic continuance of the organism. The Greek does not deny this, but he makes a useful and practical observation, namely that a man must walk before he can fly, and that before the individual can transcend all the limits of illusion and go into the noblest spheres of reality, it is first necessary for him to live well in the conditioned state in which he finds himself, attaining release by outgrowing rather than by attempting to discard the machinery of the sensory perceptions. That only when he has satisfied the demands of these faculties, has exhausted their natural contributions, and has attained a certain quietude in the presence of them, so that he may discriminate them honorably and honestly, and learn that it is not essentially the machine itself which is bad. It is the product of the machine in the term of the distortion which man permits to arise in the development of his mental-emotional structure. Beyond this, then, we pass to the next part of this, and you will see as we go along why it has a direct bearing upon the subject listed in the program, in case you think we've forgotten it. This second part is the next level in the Socratic and Greek theology, namely that above the natal demon there is a second entity or being which is called the essential demon. Now the essential demon is perhaps most comparable to Emerson's concept of the overself. The essential demon consists of the extension of the natal demonic power upward into union with that directly superior to itself. If therefore we should take the state of thought or the mental life of man and cause that man to that mental life to ascend to the next level superior to itself, we might even begin to develop a series of Neoplatonic analogies. For here we have in the Neoplatonic philosophy thought ascending toward reason, knowledge rising to union with wisdom, intellect ascending to the contemplative state of understanding. We therefore push all of these values upward, and we come upon a new kind of self, and that is the self above and beyond the intellectual self, and that is the intuitional self. The intuitional self, as the essential demon, therefore constitutes a still higher order of deities. And now we come to an interesting thought in connection with the Greek mythology, namely that the deities are also assigned to the levels of human consciousness, ascending the ladder in a natural and orderly manner, and that the conditions which we call levels of consciousness the Greeks knew as bodies or areas of divine beings. The essential demon is, of course, more remote and more difficult than the natal demon. I think we have a parallel to it in the Chinese doctrine of the transcendent being as set forth in The Secret of the Golden Flower by Willing. Here we have the Chinese recognizing that within the nature of man there is a quality or condition by means of which an imminent and immediate transcendence is possible, and that man also possesses this kind of a God possessing such qualities or attributes as omniscience, omnipotence, omniactivity, that this is the being who knows all, hears all, sees all, from which man can never depart, either in life or in death, and to which man must turn with a certain assurance that whereas his body is sustained by certain outwards, his inner life is sustained by those farther fountains flowing from the transcendent being. And that is, he is nourished upwardly by the food which enters his body, by the air that he breathes, by water, and by all the emanations of physical nature around me. So he is nourished from above downwardly by a water of life, a mysterious elixir, a wonderful and sovereign remedy, this true water of life flowing from the fountains of eternity. And those who drink thereof shall not thirst again. So the father fountains of the Chaldean oracle represent not only gods in the sky, or universal deities, or principles abiding in the abstract polydimensional space around us. They represent attributes and qualities of our own composite internal. And man is nourished essentially from within his own nature, even as his body is sustained by things outwardly. His outer mind is sustained from without by observation and experience and experimentation, producing the natal demon. His inner mind is nourished by inspiration, intuition, and participation in divine mysteries. And this flows from within himself, downward, gradually into the cognizable parts of his own consciousness. Well, this might sound like a rather long sentence, and I'm afraid it is, but I believe that the words may be a little tumbling about, but the idea is not particularly difficult. It is perhaps difficult because I'm trying to put it somewhat in the Greek phrasing rather than in our modern way of saying things. There's a certain archaic majesty in these old forms, which, like the older type of the writing of sacred writ, carries, I think, something in the soul which the modern and modernized versions of these things are deficient in conveying. In, therefore, the development of the concept of the essential demon, we have the contemplative, meditative, metaphysical discipline life which we associate with yoga, Vedanta, and the esoteric aspects of Buddhism and Zen. Here we have the individual challenged by what he might term his God. Now, let us escape again from another peculiarity that arises in this type of thinking, namely, what many millions of people, if presented with this idea suddenly, might regard as a most terrible form of idolatry, a man worshipping himself, which, of course, is not the purpose at all intended in this. Actually, to the Greek, this God is the God in us, which even the most orthodox religious person will accept if it is worded differently. Paul tells us the Christ in you, the hope of glory. And no one is offended. Yet if the same believer should say, I shall pray to my Christ, he would offend. It is just the way in which the wording is given. Because we think of these principles as universal. But the Greeks knew, and we know, that we experience them as individual and personal. And we shall not yet come to a spiritual understanding of Christianity merely by historical contemplation of the mystery in Bethlehem. We will experience only this mystery by the immediate apperception of it as an internal spiritual experience within ourselves. And this spiritual experience, this apotheistic state in which man is raised within himself to a divine level of himself, carries the essential concept of the Greek essential demon. So the essential demon is that part of man, the oversoul, the anthropos, or the overself, which abides in a luminosity, which is truly oracular, which may be known only in meditation, which may be experienced only in purity, and which sits forever like the unknown knight of the Arthurian cycle in the apparently vacant Siege Perilous at the table of the king. This is the invisible 13th part of the aggregate of the round table. Thus in the essential demon we have man coming toward or upward in the search of value. And he rises to what might be termed the periphery of his own ability to conceive the nature and state of divinity. In participation in the nature of the essential demon, man experiences deity as all wise, all good, all love, all law, all beauty, all order, and all truth. These, however, we must remember, are but the mortal vestments of eternal ideas. The term truth as a word has but slight meaning. The term truth as experienced by man has a peculiar meaning, peculiar only to man. The term good has a similar connotation, not even possessing a complete common accord in men as to that which constitutes good. Therefore, that which is a sovereignty of good for one is a deficiency of good for another. And because conscience, intuition, inspiration, all of these faculties by which man seeks inwardly to apperceive reality, these variously exercised in various times, at various places, by various persons, result in extensions of consciousness which are not identical in their symbolic interpretation into the life of the individual. Thus we may say that a Buddhist contemplating upon the proximity of the divine may feel, experience, and inwardly see this proximity in the form of a bodhisattva or celestial Buddhistic being. Whereas under the same motivation and with the same piety and the same sincerity of inward experience, the pious Christian might behold in the same way one of his most cherished saints or the likeness of the Savior himself. Yet these are vestments. These are vestments of spiritual ideas which can only come to the individual through such garments, forms, and interpretations as are supplied by his own instruments, particularly his visualizing, interpreting instruments. For he cannot give form to things which for him have no form, and he cannot bestow unknown form. He must bestow only such form as can arise from his own mind. Thus the essential daemon arises from and is sustained by the natal daemon. The natal daemon, or the intellectual experience, providing the forms and appearances. Another way of approaching this is on the Greek level of ethics, where we have the same principle, and it is a very interesting and very important key which can be conveyed through many fields of thought. We have in our thinking the famous story of the Good Samaritan, in which we have for us the most perfect, perhaps, simple, childlike example of charity. This to us then becomes charitas, which is little more nor less than brotherly love, and which we have now interpreted as a semi-voluntary process of dole, which has nothing to do with the original meaning at all. We say to charity, because we think of charitable organizations. But actually, when we give to charity, the Greek says we give to charitas. We give to love, because it is our love to give to love. We don't give to people, because to them, love was a daemon, a spiritual being, resembling again your bodhisattvic and karmic and kamic deities in Buddhism, where all principles are embodied in the tremendous pantheon of personalized energies. It is then in this way that through the concept of charity, or the Good Samaritan, we have a symbol of our own instinct to give. Now, this particular legend may have no meaning outside of our own experience, whereas another nation seeking to express the same instinct will choose a different legend, but one appropriate to its own instincts in the same general regard. One nation will draw a picture of a wise man as a person of great action, another as a person of infinite repose. These are according to the fashions of our experience, and in clothing the impulses, instincts, and outpourings of the essential daemon, we instinctively and automatically within ourselves invest these with familiar forms, so that we produce the appearances of many gods, all of which are our own fashionings around formless energies which we cannot conceive in a formless state, because conception itself is basically opposed to formlessness. It is impossible to conceive that which is inconceivable. Therefore, that which is substantially inconceivable must be reduced and dressed in conceivable form before we can know that it exists. This process takes place automatically within us in the same way, or with the same general alacrity, that certain processes occurring within the optical structure of man result in sight, although the image we see outwardly is not as an image conveyed to the brain. Thus, something is constantly happening, and this constant flowing of superior into inferior results in a constant embodying of formlessness by the apperceptive faculties of our own consciousness. This is the problem of the overshadowing, as the ancients held, by certain inspirational deities. Plotinus tells us, for example, the great Neoplatonist, that only on a few and certain occasions was he permitted to be raised up into communion and into the consciousness of his God. This is the God to whom he prayed, and whoever listened to his prayer. This was the God who could hear him, though 10 million prayed at once. And it was because of the mystery of this God that all who pray everywhere will be heard. And each will be rewarded according to his works. This to the Greeks implied the necessity of a kind of machinery in which these prayers did not ascend abstractly in space to some one remote source there to be filtered, evaluated, and measured, but that it was necessary only for man to call upon those deific attributes which were forever part of his own anthropos or over-self, forever available to him, and related to him as Krishna is related to Arjuna in the famous scene on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. Thus, to call upon the god, to call upon the name of the god, is to be heard, because it means that by attitude, by consecration, by purification, by dedication, the individual is opening the channels with his own divine nature, making it possible for that nature to flow in upon him in all emergency. And in all great periods or moments of mystical identity, this identity is union with the Anthropos, or the essential demon. The thought, as we contemplate it, becomes less startling as we think, but in the beginning it is rather to be considered as unusual. Now, we are told, for example, that man's ascent consists of a certain order of conquests, and that these conquests are related to and similar to the rituals of initiation into the state mysteries. For initiation is divided into a lesser and greater rite, as in the rites at Eleusis. These greater and lesser rites consist, therefore, of the rites of the essential demon and the rites of the natal demon. On the altars of the natal demon, man must make his first and natural offerings to the gods. And among the Greeks, all men free-born or freed, all children, all women free-born or freed, all persons not convicted of some crime or offense against the gods might be initiated into the lesser mysteries, because these mysteries simply, finally, constituted the mysteries of birth, and that all individuals born into this world as free, and all men are born free except those that are in bondage to their own karma, or to those unpaid debts by means of which they are unable to proceed in the enlightenment and elevation of their own natures. All free persons are therefore of all ages allowed to be present and to participate in the lesser rites. These lesser rites, therefore, relate to the mystery of the restoration of the natal demon, the ability of the individual to become in all things worthy of the natural faculties and abilities with which he has come to identify his own life. These include the duties of citizenship, the duties of family, the duties of the honorable maintenance of economic estate, the duties of sharing, participating, defending with honor, protecting, the duties of such natural improvements and growths as may be possible, and those duties which particularly appertain to the development of such latent and natural aptitudes as we know that we possess. For if these attributes and aptitudes be properly developed, they become ornaments, they become altars by means of which we are able to make additional and nobler sacrifices in the honor of our gods. These things, then, are the individual coming to the common state of things, coming to that problem or to that condition which we might say that, behold, we have here the honorable person. We have what Confucius might term the superior man, who is simply one who is superior to the performance of an inferior action. He cannot be made to do that which is not good. This is the lesser mystery. And by means of it, man gains an ascendancy over his natal demon. He gains union, therefore, with the least of these tutelary divinities. And he makes the important discovery that he is a god. He makes the important discovery that a spark of the eternal is within him. That therefore he is a sleeping god until he awakes. And he is a god unknowing his own godhood until he becomes aware thereof. And by means of the nature of the natal demon, he is brought to the point where he realizes that the power to think, the power and courage to do, all of these things spark finally from the highest attribute of the natal demon, which is the will. For out of the apperception of things as they are, comes the will to do those things which are necessary. So the natal demon supplies the will motivation by means of which man conquers this world or is deficient in such conquest and therefore fails in his proper achievement. In the wanderings of Odysseus, as Apuleius tells us in his essay on the cave of the nymphs, in the wanderings of Ulysses or Odysseus, the natal demon is represented by the cyclop, inasmuch as the cyclop, or the titanic self, the compound structure of the mind, the one-eyed guardian, who remains dangerous until the stake is driven through its eye, represents the ego, which remains dangerous until the stake is driven through the ego or it is deprived of its authority. The ego being really a term synonymous with I, or selfness, or selfhood. Now we might say that it sounds rather unpleasant that we have worked up such a nice account of what a pleasant being the natal demon is, only to learn that it is a nasty old cyclop. But let us also remember that at the time of this particular occasion, Ulysses was going somewhere, and he was very, very anxious to get there. And because of certain deeds and actions which had long previously been performed, Ulysses or Odysseus had brought down upon himself the wrath or antagonism of Poseidon, Lord of the Sea. He would have had no trouble with poor Ulysses, with the Cyclop, had he not been on a journey. And in this journey, he was brought under the hazard of the Cyclop as one of the 12 tests which make up the story of the Odyssey. The natal demon is exactly then the combination of the Greek thought and the Buddhistic thought. When man has reached identity with intellect, he comes to the most dangerous point in his entire development as a being. When he is less than intellect, he is less than self. When he is intellect alone, he is less than nothing. And it is a peculiar situation. Because the mind, when permitted as the natal demon to obsess or to take over those privileges and prerogatives which belong to a superior power, then changes from a guardian to a tyrant. A man who has first had to rise above the inconstancies and inconsistencies of the flesh, in effort to unite himself with his mind, must now rise above the more treacherous, cruel, and terrible dangers of the mind in order to proceed therefrom toward identity with the essential demon. This we will get a little later as we approach the next phase of our problem. But here we see man's struggle toward a mystical at-one-ment, or unification with the over-self. The over-self now being a personalized concept of the true nature of God. Personalized not necessarily merely as the worship of another human being, but personalized in the sense that we personalize deity in art. Not because we believe, actually, that God looks like the elderly gentleman on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel in Rome, but because in this form we give a venerable, we give a majestic similitude to that which we essentially know to be formless. It becomes a convenient symbol. Now, internally, we live likewise in a world of symbols. And when we reach union with the essential demon, we work or achieve union with the most exalted symbol by which we can objectively cognize or contemplate that which in its substance is beyond cognition or contemplation. So the essential demon represents the vague yet majestic form by which we attempt to portray that which supersedes or is superior to all known other forms. It is good better than all the good that we know, but still bound in the basic concept of good. It is wisdom wiser than the wisdom of all mortals, yet held within the framework of the concept of wisdom. It is law, more honorable, more perfect, more just, more universal than any law that we can conceive of. Yet we conceive of it as law, although it transcends. We have to use this essential concept. And these concepts, retiring from the obvious to the subtle, become archetypal. And as archetypal concepts, we express them as divinities. That was the basic concept of the original Greek theology. Now, the second point, we've carried our little story of the godlings for a moment about as far as we can, because we have to combine this now with another entirely different group of patterns. The Greeks had a philosophy of images. This philosophy of images also did not die with them. It took a certain change of color and appearance and survived into Christianity, very largely in the profusion of religious images which have adorned the churches of Europe for nearly 2,000 years. These images are venerable, but according to the mind of the church, they are not sacred. They are venerable, but not sacred. They are sacred in the sense that to profane them, or to injure them, to destroy them, to mutilate them, would be an act of impiety to the principle for which they stand. But the images per se and of themselves are for the most part not regarded to have a particular virtue unless that virtue is communicated to them by the presence of holy relics. If the image is a reliquary to contain certain sacred remains, then those remains may also have a further sanctity, as of course in the remains or relics of saints. And canonization in the church usually involves or requires the evidence of miraculous intercession as the result of relics or prayers or of other means by which the assistance of the sanctified person has been requested or supplicated. Now the Greeks have also, or did have, a concept of images, and it is quite useless for us to assume that they worship their statues of Zeus, Hades, and Poseidon any more than the American Indians. I've talked to the old medicine priest down where they make the little kachinas and all the little sacred images. They tell you definitely they do not worship these. They are not gods, but they are similitudes. They are like oriental mandalas. They are visible things which cause us to remember invisible things, causing us to bring to mind or to restore out of the depths of thought or memory certain truths, principles, ideals, or realities which might otherwise not be immediately accessible to us. The Greeks went a little further, however, than this. They declared, following Pythagoras and the Egyptians, that all forms in nature are in sympathetic relationship to similar forms, that forms of a kind or of a type, sanctified under a circumstance or condition, have natural and peculiar virtues because of similitude. Paracelsus developed this very intensely in his theory of sympathies and antipathies. When, therefore, the conqueror Xerxes entered the great temple of the Olympian Zeus and stood in the presence of the magnificent statue of gold with a face of ivory and crowned with a wreath of olive, and bearing in one upraised hand the gilded ivory figure of victory. The great conqueror, looking up 30 feet above him into the face of this deity, suddenly fell on his knees and relented his previous determination of destroying the sanctuary. He went quietly therefrom and ordered that it should not be disturbed. Now the Greek says to us, the image is ivory, trimmed neatly with gold. We know the man who carved it. We know that it is inanimate. We know that of itself it is but a gilded earth. But what caused Xerxes to change his mind? That's the question. Had this image been different, would the conqueror still have paused? If a man had come up and told him certain truths, would he have let that man speak, or would he have slain him before he could have uttered the words? What was it that stopped Xerxes? Psychologically, the answer is rather obvious: sublimity. Xerxes was overwhelmed, as we are often overwhelmed, in the presence of extraordinary majesty, great beauty, of wonderful ritual or ceremony. Whether we are converted to its processes or not, we are still moved by the impact of the dynamic solemnity and majesty of the occasion. What is this? What is this impact? What is majesty? What is sublimity? It is the presentation by the great conception of art, whether visible or musical, it can be musical, of archetypal forms.